Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Tone Rx podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Lamb.
Hi, everyone.
Sean is on the light and sound. How are you, Sean?
Not too bad. How are you?
And before we get into it, we're after rearranging the studio to make utilise our lovely vinyls on the wall. What do you think, Tim?
I'm still adapting, James.
Yeah.
I'm still adapting.
You're under the steeple there, the famous Shandon steeple.
I'm looking at some of the different areas. There's corners of the room I never saw before, and there's cobwebs everywhere. So
we're like newsreaders, Nari News or something like that. And then our guest today is the Director General of the Irish Prison Service, Karen McCaffrey.
Morning, James. Morning, Jimmy. Lovely to be here.
Is that like the CEO of prisons?
Effectively, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, before we get into it, the backdrop you have here is a beautiful painting by Keith Anderson. It's from Baker's Road, which is just below Knocknaheeny, looking over the north side out into the harbour. So just for people that are kind of catching the eye, that's Grána Brath Church to your right. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you go behind Grána Brath Church and up that way, the prison, and you know where we are at the moment, mm-hmm. actually, across the river is Montanari, and just over that hill then is Cork Prison.
Okay.
So you'll probably be up there after anyway.
I will.
So before we get into the work you're doing at the moment, for the people that don't know you, where are you from, where did you grow up, and how did you get into this role?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Castleknock in Dublin. I spent most of my childhood there. I'm currently living in Longford. So I've been in the prison service for 16 years in the prison service decentralised to Longford. And so I moved lock, stock and barrel, and I'm very happily living there. And I've got a couple of kids who are country kids now. So actually, I couldn't ever contemplate going back to a city. So really happy to be where I'm living, and really happy to be where I'm working. So as you say, I'm currently Director General of the Prison Service. I've had this role for 4 years now. I'm incredibly privileged to be in the role and to serve our staff, of whom we have over 3,500, to serve the people in our care, who today we have almost 4,400, and then to serve broader society in terms of working really hard within our service to achieve better outcomes for people in our care, which is to the benefit of everybody in our communities.
So did you said you started in the prison service 16 years ago. What did you do before that?
So I joined the Department of Justice straight out of college. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I did an arts degree, as many people do, and followed my passion, which was English and history at the time. I did a master's in international relations, politics, economics and law, and then joined the Department of Justice. I always knew, I suppose, I wanted to be a public servant. I think growing up, I wanted to be a teacher, but ended up joining the Department of Justice, spent 6 years there and joined the prison service. And I suppose I always saw it as accidental that I ended up in the prison service. But my mum did a lovely thing for all of us when we turned 40, and she made a memory box for all of us. And my dad was in the army and he served abroad. So she'd saved all the letters we'd sent to him. And there was a letter I had sent to him when I was 14 and studying potentially not so hard for my junior cert and talking about what I wanted to do. And I was saying I wanted to be a teacher, but actually I'd like to teach in prisons. So I've always had a strong sense of social justice and always believed that education, you know, is a real leveller and can provide so much opportunity for everybody. And unfortunately, access isn't always equal and people don't always have equality of opportunity. So it's interesting, actually, that I'm in the role I'm in. And I think it's not necessarily accidental and more hopefully, you know, by fate that I find myself in a role that I'm really, really passionate about and really dedicated to.
It's one of those roles as well within our society that you have so much, like, people are looking at you to make these changes, not just the public in general, but people like myself and James, who would have been in prison before, and make positive changes. So down the line, guys, they look at prison as a place where they can, it's rehabilitation, they can learn, they can get education, learn about themselves, get mental health services within there. And like, is that a big emphasis for you at the moment?
It's a huge emphasis for me. So I have an international role at the moment. I'm also president of Europriz, which represents 35 prison services internationally in terms of promoting best practice. And when I speak anywhere, both nationally or internationally, I'm really clear about the role of the prison service. And our role is not just to lock people up. Our role is to unlock potential. And what we see as our core role every day is to find the potential in people so that they can realise their full potential and go on to have a different narrative and a different story for their futures. So I'm really, really clear that our role isn't to lock people up, but that our role is to unlock potential. And I mean, I always say, and people always think that prisons, you know, are really grim and they're dark places and it's really, really difficult. But, you know, I think for some people, they see prisons as places of punishment. But I'm really clear, prisons cannot be seen as places of punishment and can't be operated as places of punishment. And for me, our prisons are places of hope and opportunity. And everybody who's within our care has a hope to lead a better future for themselves and their family. And everybody then, during their time in our care, has an opportunity really to find personal growth, to find personal self-esteem, and to deal with the issues that generally have given rise to their offending in the first place. So be it an addiction, a mental health issue in terms of educational disadvantage and low levels of educational attainment, issues in terms of not having employability skills. So really, for me, our prisons are places of hope and opportunity, and all of our focus and all of our emphasis then is about giving people opportunity. Because if we see our prisons as places of punishment and our role is simply to contain people, then we're not adding to safer communities and we're not contributing to a safer Ireland, because people will then leave and more likely go on to commit more offences and potentially more serious offences, because prison in and of itself is criminogenic. So what we need to ensure that we do with people in our care is give them all of that, those opportunities that maybe they've never had in their lives before, quite sadly, so that they can reach their full potential, not just while they're in their care, but more importantly, that they can reach their full potential on the outside. So I think traditionally, maybe prisons might have been seen as places of punishment. And I think the prison service probably saw its job ending when somebody walked out the gate. But I suppose what we've come to realise over the last few years is actually people make so many significant gains in terms of their personal development while they're in prison. And it's that bridge between prison and the community that we're now focusing on and really need to focus more on, because all of those gains can be lost if you're going out without strong family support, if you're going out without accommodation, if you're going out without the opportunity to further your education or training, if you're going out, you know, it's an active addiction that you haven't had treated, if you're going out with a mental illness where you're not stabilised and have a bridge or a pathway into support in the community.
That's a fantastic point that you made there around the secondary service after prison. Because if somebody really, and I know this and know James know this, if somebody really wants to get the help within the prison system when they're ready, there are plenty of services there. There's the education, there's personal development groups in there, there's drug counselling, psychology. There's so much there. I know some of the departments are really bombarded with so many, and that's very, and I know we'll probably talk about that in a bit, but I think the integration back into society, particularly if you're leaving a family, your family, to go into prison and you're going back into that same family, if that family has a lot of mental health issues, mm-hmm. there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of drug and alcohol abuse, mm-hmm. Criminality, you don't have much of a chance if that's the only home you have to go back into. You know, and like, we're fortunate here in Cork that we have the Cork Alliance and they do help out, and there's a safe place to go for the lads and stuff. But is there anything else that is in the pipeline maybe down the line that you think would be a great way to actually help the lads even outside of prison?
Yeah, and as I say, you know, we've stopped seeing our role as ending when somebody leaves our care, because if we can't help people get the support they need in their communities, then they are unfortunately back on a pathway into our custody in the future. So there's a huge amount we need to do. I think communities have a huge role to play. Everybody comes from a community. Everybody goes back to a community. And communities, in my view, really need to step up and become more involved in terms of giving people a second chance. And I know we were all at an event in Google recently, you know, where we had a group of employers in the room and we were explaining the importance of giving people a second chance. Because what I say to people is that people who are leaving our custody are vastly different people. In the majority of cases, particularly where they've spent a long enough period in time in prison so that we can help people address their issues, they're vastly different people than they were when they were committed to prison. So there's a huge piece around society giving those who've been in contact with the criminal justice system a second chance. And I suppose we talk about rehabilitation and reintegration, but I mean, realistically, you know, many people who come to custody come from socially and economically marginalised communities where they were never integrated into a community. And it's not about rehabilitating or reintegrating. It's finding a pathway for somebody to reach their full potential within our communities. And we can only do that with community support. So we need employers. We need third level institutions, you know, our colleges, our adult education centres, to really see that they have a significant role to play for people who are coming out of custody, to help them reach their potential in the community. And we've been making great progress in relation to that. I think it's fair to say we've got the Working for Change strategy, which is around employment. And that started out looking at social enterprise, but I always had an ambition that it needed to be much broader, because social enterprise is quite a niche. But what we need employers to see is the journey of change and transformation that people have undergone in prison, and also see that they have so many skills to give and that there's an incredibly talented workforce, you know, within our care at the moment, who've got something, you know, that employers want and employers need. Similarly, in terms of third level education, we've been working really closely with Minister Simon Harris. And for the first time, the National Access Plan for Higher Education was published recently. And people in contact with the criminal justice system have been identified as a marginalised group. And I think that's what we need to see more of. We need service in our community to see people in our custody as citizens, and then for them to provide a really good service to people on their release. But I think we also need to be clear that it's not equality of access. And I was really clear with the minister in relation to this in terms of education. There's more support needed. There's more wraparound services to help somebody and to give them the opportunity. So just getting a place on a course or just getting a place in education isn't enough. What you need are wraparound services and ongoing support and mentoring for people to realise their full potential.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the term there, criminogenic, and people might know what that means, but just what Timmy spoke about there, if you're in an environment where there's poverty, mental health, antisocial behaviour, drug use, these all contribute towards crime and criminal behaviour. And the word that they use is a criminogenic environment. Okay. And if you're in a landing, in a prison where there's no services, I suppose, because some people look at prison as like punishment, they shouldn't have TVs, they shouldn't have kettles, but that is a criminogenic environment, and that contributes to recidivism, which means reoffending afterwards. So what would you say to people that have the belief that TVs, gyms and kettles and things like that should be taken from, they should be locked up? Can you explain why people are afforded such comforts, or maybe are treated more humanely than others would like, and how that helps to reduce crime?
Yeah, I suppose we're always really conscious in all of our work in relation to victims of crime, and we know that a lot of harm has been done to people in our communities because they've been victims of crime. We can't change what's happened to that person, but what we can change is ensuring that no future victims of crime are created. So if we were to take somebody into our custody and simply lock them up, not treat them with decency, not treat them with humanity and empathy, and not work with them to address the issues that gave rise to their offending, more victims of crime will be created in our communities. So the reason, you know, we have a very humane and a very empathetic approach within our prisons is because it gives the person the best opportunity to make the best use of that time to turn their lives around. So where I suppose previously the value proposition of imprisonment was seen as incapacitation. So you could take somebody dangerous off the streets. And of course, you know, you are incapacitated while you're in custody. But we're not going to reduce your risk of reoffending again if we don't work with you to deal with the issues that gave rise to your offending. So if we don't have really good addiction services to help people, you know, deal with an addiction, if we don't have incredible education services to give people, it's not a second chance at education. In many cases, it's the first chance at education and to reach their potential and grow their self-belief and self-esteem. If we can't give people work training opportunities that will give them skills on release for employment, if we can't model pro-social behaviour, you know, in terms of all of our engagements and interactions, well, then we're not going to serve society well, because we won't be reducing the likelihood of the person in our care reoffending when they're released. So our whole system is around, built around humanity. And unfortunately, not all prison systems are built on those principles. So I spoke recently at an international, a worldwide conference, actually, and people were really taken aback by the level of humanity and the level of empathy that the Irish Prison Service has for people in its care. And this conference was in the States, actually, and I declined an invitation to go and visit an American prison, because in that prison, offenders weren't allowed to look at the staff. They had to turn their backs to people as they walked by. And for me, that's inhumane. And if we treat people inhumanely, then we won't expect those people to take that opportunity, you know, that a sentence gives, in terms of addressing the reasons that they've found themselves in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, but I think if you look at, like, either side of the water, that, you know, between the UK and between America, like, we can be thankful for, I suppose, what we have. We all know the horror stories from Rikers Island and how prison officers, you know, facilitate violence and stuff like that. I was up in the prison recently doing we were delivering an addiction studies course, and there's about 14 in the group, and they commented on the recruit prison officers, the new prison officers, being more open and you know, just having more of an understanding and having less judgment and stuff like that. But that's not by accident. That was the design of the new recruitment. Myself and Sheila Connolly had a little input into that. But will you explain to the people that's listening and watching, well, I suppose, the ethos behind the new recruitment?
Yeah, so actually I was responsible for that. I was director of HR at the time. And I suppose what we traditionally been recruiting people into the role of a prison officer, we were looking at security focused, you know, skills. And again, that was because, you know, traditionally we saw imprisonment as being first and foremost around security and safety. So what we did was we got some occupational psychologists to go in and spend time in landing in a prison and to find out what it is to make a really good prison officer, because we know that a prison officer within the prison system has the most positive impact on somebody on their landing. And we all know class officers, the whole system, who are such a positive influence and who can really encourage and motivate and support
people in custody. You often have a situation like where fellas want to get onto that landing because that's the more chilled out landing, that's the more relaxed landing. And like a class officer could have the landing under control by consent, because he's personable, he's you know, has a bit of awareness. Yeah. All it takes is for one officer to walk through that landing with an attitude and this upheaval, you know.
Yeah. So we have a really finite number of services within our prison. So we have a finite number of psychologists, very small, unfortunately, a finite number of teachers, a finite number of addiction counsellors, and the majority of our staff are uniform prison grades. So we know that if we have, you know, really motivated staff who are not judgmental, so I suppose what we did is changed our recruitment model, and we've gone for a values-based approach to recruitment. So what we're looking for are people who believe that others deserve a second chance. We're looking for people with strong resilience, because it is difficult working in a prison and it's not an environment that everybody can survive in. So we're really looking for people you know, who have that positive attitude, who see people in our custody, in our care, as deserving of an opportunity to turn their lives around. And I think that's been reflected, but it's not just in our new recruits, I would say. You know, we have incredible prison officers right throughout our service. Yeah. And for me, it's one of the proudest things that we have in our service is the relational you know, element within our service. So the relationships between staff and people in our care in the prison system in Ireland, I don't think is replicated in any other jurisdiction. And when I have other people over visiting, they can't believe the level of engagement, the level of trust, the level of respect. And respect is a two-way thing. And we know that if we've good relationships between our prison staff and people in our care, it leads to a safer environment, a less stressful environment for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, both somebody who's living in the environment and both somebody who's working in the environment. So we've put a huge amount of effort into our recruitment process, but also in relation to continuous professional development. So that's a new enough concept in the prison service. You know, previously you were recruited and you didn't get any training. Mm. Whereas now we have a lot of training, and we're providing a lot of training in terms of being trauma-informed. So certainly we have an ambition to be a trauma-informed service. And at the moment I'm looking at restorative justice. And I think restorative justice has got huge potential for our service in terms of dealing with inter-prisoner conflict, staff conflict amongst staff, conflict amongst prisoners and staff. So simultaneous to us developing a current strategy, we're developing a restorative justice strategy for the service. And I think that has huge potential because prisons are about people and they're about relationships. Yeah. And if the relationships aren't right, you know, then everything else becomes much more difficult. Right. So I'm really proud of our staff and I'm really proud of the work that they do every day within our landings.
I was just going to mention, you mentioned something earlier about just being humane to people in prison. I think that's very important because a lot of the people in prison may have had some form of difficulty in their life growing up or whatever it may have been. And they may have lost all forms of trust against humanity, really, yeah, and everybody around them. So so I suppose if they're to be in prison and they're being treated badly like everybody else who's just turned their back on them, but if they're being treated with respect, given a little bit of responsibility, you know, an officer saying hello to them in the morning instead of, come on, you, get up. Do you know, that goes so far, you know, it goes so far with somebody. It actually shows them, you're showing them that there is hope in life, you know, there is hope and people are good.
Yeah.
Because the people on the outside, for them, they may be involved in all forms of crime and drugs and whatever it may be. It doesn't matter. But if they're in here and they're seeing, like, do you know what, there are people good, that could be the first step to them maybe saying, do you know what, I'm going to go up to the psychologist, or I'm going to go up to the next personal development group in the school, or I might even do my junior cert.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff is very, very, very important. It's about being nice. No matter if the prisoner, sometimes, Karen and I have noticed this, sometimes you get some prisoners who are, after being hurt so much in their lives. Now, let's be honest, there's the backstory as well, we're talking about victims, but they've been hurt so much in life that they have this angry demeanour, they treat everybody like with, you know, they're the ones we need to work a little bit harder on instead of just really pushing them to the side and
absolutely and say, you know. Agreed. Yeah, and I think some people have a perception that our prisons are full of bad people, and our prisons are not full of bad people. Yeah. Of course, somebody has committed an offence. Of course, they have caused harm. Of course, they've made bad choices, but they're not inherently bad people. And in my view, there is inherent good in everybody. Mm. And our job is to find that inherent goodness and to help people see that they have a value and that they have a contribution to make to society, even if, you know, they haven't seen, you know, that where they can make that contribution. And you're so right in relation to trauma. So, you know, yes, people in custody, you know, have caused harm, but the majority of people in our care are victims also, and victims of trauma, and have grown up and been subjected, you know, to significant adverse childhood experiences, which then regrettably, you know, have made them much more likely, you know, to end up engaging in crime. So we know if somebody has four or more adverse childhood incidents, they're 7 times more likely to have hurt themselves or others in the last 12 months and 11 times more likely to have used Class A drugs or to end up in prison. Mm. And then we know that of those who end up in our custody, 60% of their children will end up in custody. So it's really, really important for Ireland and for society that we stop that cycle of offending and that we intervene. And I'm sure we'll get to it later. But for me, the intervention, and we talk a lot about what happens in prison, what happens after prison. But for me, the intervention needs to take place at a much earlier stage in the community,
yeah,
because there is a pipeline, unfortunately, into our prisons. And there's a pipeline from school to imprisonment. And if we can focus our attention and our resources into actually supporting vulnerable families in the community, then I think that's going to have the greatest impact in terms of cutting that pipeline from school to imprisonment. And of course, you know, we will always need prisons. Of course, there are people who commit serious offences, you know, and the appropriate punishment is the deprivation of liberty. But for a lot of people who come in contact with our service and find themselves caught up in the criminal justice system, it's because they have addictions and mental health issues that are related to trauma and childhood trauma.
Yes, you made a great point there, and I'm just going to bring it back to somebody there that we had on recently on the podcast. She's a judge from the US, and she's
in Broward County in Florida.
She's over a mental health court where people who have mental health issues come into the court, and they thought they might have caused some bit of
district court charges.
Yeah,
so non-violent defences.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah. And I'll leave James finish after this point here, because James knows the story backwards. But the way they manage her over there on site in her court, you know, it's so informal. You know, it's like they walk in, and she asks, "How are you doing? How's things? You know, are you okay? Is everybody treating you well? You know." But back here in the course, it's like, stand up straight or whatever. You know, my experience is down through the line there before. It was a horrible place. I hated the courthouse. But do you think, because we have so many different people within our prison system in this country who suffer with their mental health, that we could ever have some form of strategy like that, or our system set up where people who really, really have mental health issues go to a place like this, and instead of going into the prison system, we can put them into a hospital where they can get treated properly?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was appointed Director General back in December 2018, the first issue I brought to the Secretary General and to the Department of Justice was around, you know, just the high level of people who ended up in our care and in our custody, whose underlying issue was not a criminal issue, but was a mental health issue. So when we look at the statistics, on any given day, there's 250 people in custody who are on the caseload of the National Forensic Mental Health Service. So they're people with, you know, really acute needs in terms of psychosis or schizophrenia. For many of those people, and particularly within our remand population, a lot of people end up in our custody because they're not in a position to access mental health services in the community. So my ask of the department was that we would set up a task force working between ourselves and the Department of Health and the HSE. It's great that that task force was established and has recently concluded its work. And I suppose it has three different focuses. The first is in relation to diversion. So where a guard comes upon somebody who has a public order offence or is acting in a way, you know, that is of concern, where the underlying issue is a mental health issue, that the guards have the ability to divert somebody to an appropriate treatment centre. And unfortunately, what often happens is to ensure public safety and to ensure the safety of that person, they're brought to our service. Yeah. And we give an incredible service. When I think of Cloverhill Prison in particular, and the specific landing we have to look after people who are acutely mentally unwell, they get an incredible service. But that service should not be provided in a custodial setting. It's not a therapeutic environment. And that person is generally only in contact with the criminal justice system by virtue of an untreated mental health need. So there is a new pathway been developed in terms of diversion to allow the guards not to bring somebody to the prison system, but to be able to divert them first and foremost to an appropriate treatment centre in the community. The second element of that task force then was looking at people who are in our custody and who are serving sentences, who have significant mental health issues. So we're currently doing a piece of work to, I suppose, identify a dedicated unit within the prison service where we would have an enhanced mental health service. So, as I say, we have a number of places within our service where the National Forensic Mental Health Service provide a really excellent in-reach service, but we'd like to have a dedicated unit that would potentially be co-managed and co-led with the National Forensic Mental Health Service and would be much more therapeutic in terms of its approach. So we're well on the way to establishing that at the moment within our service. And then the third part of the mental health task force was looking at the through care piece. And again, really, really important when somebody goes out, that they're going out into a service and that they have stability and continuity of care. So that mental health task force has recently concluded its work. And I know the first meeting in terms of the implementation plan of all of those recommendations is happening within the department next week. So there is a new blueprint in terms of how we manage people with mental illness within the criminal justice system. And I'm really looking forward to that being implemented, because prison is not the place for people with severe enduring mental illness. And on any given day, we have 14 or 15 people waiting admission to the Central Mental Hospital. And those are people who are acutely, acutely unwell, who are living within our prisons and who we're providing excellent care. But no matter how amazing the care our staff and our clinicians give to those people, it's not sufficient, because, a prison is not a therapeutic environment, and we don't have the facilities or the resources that they need to get better.
Hello, everybody. Just to remind you all, we are in the Opera House on 8 p.m. Saturday, the 25th of March, with Jimmy Barry Murphy and Shane Casey.
Yeah, two very, very important figures in Cork City.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Barry Murphy, one of the most inspirational sports stars we had in this city, and Shane Casey.
Yeah.
One Billy of the characters of the city.
Yeah. The real offender will meet the young offender, as it were. But if you're interested in getting tickets, you can just go into the description of this video. And there's not that many left either. And we sold out last year. So don't be disappointed when we see you there. Yes. Saturday, 25th of March.
Thank you. Next. I was just thinking, there, you know, a lot of the people that are going to prison, a lot of them have drug addiction, alcoholism, and whatever else. They're addicted to these things. And these, like drugs and alcohol, they help people cope and it helps them to soothe. And, you know, we know how all that works. But when that's taken and you're put into prison, what you're left with is the underlying issues around trauma, mental health, whatever they're drinking on, it doesn't matter. You know, and you've people inside in the prisons like who are trying to cope with all these different things as well, you know, issues from the past and whatever, drug addiction. What is the best way for the prison system to be able to deal with people coming into the prison system like that?
Yeah, so I mean, 70% of people who come into our custody have an active addiction, be it drugs or alcohol. And the drug-seeking behaviour, as you know, doesn't stop at the prison gate. So, like, it's a really significant issue. And actually, increasingly of late, it's a really difficult issue in terms of just the level of drugs, you know, that have been thrown over perimeter walls into our prisons. And where somebody, and you're absolutely right, where you have an active addiction on the outside. And as I gave that statistic earlier, if you've got a lot of childhood trauma, you're 11 times more likely to be using Class A drugs. And that is to soothe and to regulate yourself. So when that is cut off, I appreciate it's really, really difficult. But what we see, unfortunately, is a lot of people who spend a lot of their time in custody continuing that drug-seeking behaviour and continuing, you know, to maintain their addiction while they're in a custody. I see custody as a really great opportunity for people to actually deal with their addiction. So at the moment, we're actually working our keeping drugs out of prison policy. But I suppose we need to be realistic. So long as we have people actively using drugs in our community, prisons are just a reflection of society. Yeah. There will be people within our prisons actively using drugs. So I think the focus needs to be on, you know, the broader societal issue. But what we can do, I suppose, is enhance the services that we have to help people deal with their addiction. We have incredible addiction counsellors within our service, and Merchants Quay provide a really great service. And we certainly need to expand that. There's a lot more we can do, I think, to support people. We are at the moment looking at identifying a drug treatment unit, so similar to the unit I described earlier, which would be a bespoke unit. So we have got a drug treatment program in the medical unit in Mountjoy. But I suppose the question is, when somebody has completed that programme and they go back into an environment where drugs are freely available, it's really difficult to have the motivation to stay drug-free. So we're looking to try to identify a facility within the estate which would be a drug-free prison, so that we would transition people from the medical unit when they've completed the drug treatment programme into a unit where they're stable. But I suppose it's a constant challenge for us to keep drugs out of our prison. So we've gotten very sophisticated at front of house. At the moment, we're investing in even more technology in terms of ensuring that visitors aren't bringing drugs into prison. And I do appreciate that a visitor or a family or a friend member could be under pressure, absolutely, and could think they're actually doing somebody a service, yeah. You know, by bringing in drugs. But the reality is it's actually the opposite, because we need to cut the flow of drugs down so that people can see it as an opportunity. So we're working with the guards at the moment around our perimeter security to see what we can do to stop people throwing drugs in. But really, it's a societal question in terms of addiction and drug use. And so long as we continue to have addiction within our communities, then we'll continue to see drugs within our prison. And as I say, you know, what we need is a much more trauma-informed response within our communities to help people deal with their addictions so that addiction doesn't lead them down a pathway of criminality.
Well, back in the early days of this podcast, one of our first guests was John Lonergan, who was the Mountjoy governor for a long time. And he spoke about prison is not there to judge people or punish people. They get that in court, and that we're there to, you know, provide a service for them and to look after them. And I think that maybe he was, he obviously was a very compassionate man, and he met us up in Timmy's house. We were recording at the time, and You know, just the idea of a prison governor walking through a council estate in the north side of Cork City. But as some of the lads that would have been in Mountjoy back in the day would have said, he can do that because he treated people with respect, you know. But I think when you treat people with respect, you can unlock that potential. There was one prison officer that I had a good relationship with, Miss Stack up in Cork Prison. I hope she don't mind me saying her name, but I might ask her permission afterwards. But she was probably the first prison officer, first adult really, outside of my mum and dad, that used to say to me, James, you have a lot of potential. Do you know, you're intelligent and you could do things with your life. And she used to see me coming in for a few months and going out for a few months, come back in very poor condition, being released, you know, like a shiny penny, coming back in a very poor, it was just addiction, the cycle of addiction, and go back into the environment. And she used to, you know, I suppose, give me positive affirmations, positive reinforcement. You're better than this, you can do more, you have a brain, you know. That stuff stays with you.
Yeah.
Much more so than, are you going out to the air or not, the typical. But if somebody just shows you a little bit of time, a little bit of a kind word, it could, you know, you might never see, you're planting seeds, I suppose, you're planting seeds.
And I say it actually every time, so I do medal award ceremonies, I've been doing those recently. And I mean, what I'm saying when I'm thanking prison officers for their service is that, you know, unbeknownst to them, they have touched the lives of so many people who've come through the system and been a positive influence and a positive role model. And as you say, and potentially the first positive role model that person has had in their life. And it is about respect, and it's also about not being judgmental. So we do not judge anybody. Yeah. Irrespective of your offence, everybody is treated equally. Everybody is treated with equal respect. And what we do is obviously assess a person's risk in terms of their potential to harm others or to be harmed. But nobody is judged within our service. You're right. And John Lonergan is right. The judgment and the punishment happens. Do you know what I mean? At a court level.
Yeah.
And when you come to us, what we're trying to do is to build you up as opposed to knock you back or to break you down. And I think that's really important. And it goes to the heart of the philosophy of the Irish prison system approach. And I think it has real dividend in terms of, as I say, unlocking people's potential. And when we look at our values as an organisation, one of our values is potential, and that's seeing the potential of our staff and seeing the potential of everybody in our care. And I suppose everybody is bigger than their biggest mistake, and that's not just people in our care and custody, it's everybody. Everybody has the opportunity to be better, to do better, you know, to work in themselves, to reach their potential, to find their potential, you know, and to learn. And I'm sure we'll come to education.
Before we go into the education, I want to ask you one more thing about the addiction side of stuff. So, like, Merchants Kieran provide a great service, the psychology provide a great service, but there's a finite number, as you said yourself, and there's a lot of prisoners. So sometimes, especially people that are doing short sentences, mightn't get the opportunity to meet those. But what they can do when they get out is go to NA meetings. And one of the things the lads brought up to me in the prison the last time was the lack of NA meetings. And they said that if you're interested in woodwork, you can go to the school and go to woodwork. Or if you're interested in crafts, you can go to crafts. Or if you're interested in English, you can go to English. He said, but for those of us in recovery or interested in mental health and trying to better ourselves, we've nowhere to go. Like, we might do this course for 8 weeks, but then that's gone. But do you think that there's an opportunity for, I suppose, to get NA back into the prisons, for to have, like, between myself and Timmy, and this is just thinking out loud now, if myself and Timmy went in and ran a 10-week course, then that addiction studies at 8 weeks, maybe another NGO might go in and do 8 weeks. But between us all together, there's no reason why every Friday in the prison is like recovery day in the school, and people interested in that could actually go. And because when they get out, they mightn't have access to Merchants Quay, they mightn't have access to psychologists, but they definitely will have access to the stuff that's in the community, like NA and different, you know, NGOs.
I think it's an incredible point to make. And I suppose one of the things we're doing now, where we're looking at service design and delivery, I mean, I think that those programs should be led by people who are in custody. So I meet a lot of people who've done addiction courses and addiction studies, who've dealt with their addiction in prison. And they're the most powerful influencer, I think, in terms of people who are within the environment who have an active addiction. So one of the things, and we'll talk about it later, I'm sure, around our new strategy, is just looking at service design and delivery. And one of the things we learned during COVID through the Red Cross is that the peer-led approach works best. So I would absolutely be interested in that, but I'd want to bring it further. further so that we were training, you know, people within our care to run those programs themselves. Because, you know, if you have the lived experience, then you have got much more potential to relate to somebody, you know, who's been, you know, who's on the same pathway as you, but maybe, you know, a couple of steps back. So there's huge potential there, and definitely we'll make sure that that's a critical part of the amended and updated Keeping Drugs Out of Prison strategy.
And you see, like, the peer-led stuff, like the mediation service, you see it in Cork started over as a traveller mediation service, but now it's for settled people as well. But I've seen, like, if you get the right people in and train them as mediators, they tend to be a little bit older, maybe doing a bigger sentence that the other lads will look up to.
Yeah.
They're resolving long-term feuds, you know?
Absolutely. So I met that class who recently graduated in Cork, and like, I'm such a strong supporter of the mediation service. And then its potential. So, I mean, we're looking at restorative justice as a potential strategy to be employed. And when we look at what the mediators in Cork specifically are doing in terms of, you know, engaging with new committals who are looking to go on protection, which means they're going to limit their ability to engage with services, you know, having a dialogue with those people, having a dialogue with those within the prison with whom they believe there is an issue or a problem, and really trying to encourage people, you know, to be active citizens within their community and take opportunity, avail of the opportunities that are there for them. So mediation and restorative justice, all of those practices have huge potential within our service. But for me, they need to be peer led. And I think there's a huge opportunity for the prison service in terms of giving employment to ex-offenders. So I stand up in front of employers and I say, give people a second chance. But I'm really clear. And actually had this discussion with my senior management team last week. We need to be leaders in relation to this. We need to be giving employment opportunities. We need to be looking at service design being co-delivered by people either in our custody or people formerly in our custody if we want to achieve better outcomes for people in our care.
How do you respond to gangland? Is it difficult? Like, I know protection can be a difficult thing to do. Like, if people have to be segregated for their own safety, but then even within that segregation, does people have to be segregated again? Is that increasingly difficult? As it's probably more of a phenomenon in Dublin with the gangland and stuff. It used to be Limerick, not so much in Cork. But does that put an extra strain on the service? How do you manage all that?
It's a huge strain on the service, but I always look at it from the point of view of the person themselves. So if you come into custody and you look to go on protection, then you're going to spend much more time behind the door. That isn't good for your mental health. You're going to limit your ability to go to school, to go to work training, you know, to engage in positive activities that will help you, you know, develop a better future for yourself. So in Ireland, actually, and I haven't been able to find another jurisdiction that allows people to self-select to go on protection. In every other country, it's done on a risk assessment. So I have an ambition to change the prison rules, actually, to no longer allow people to self-select to go on protection, because what people are actually looking for in a lot of cases are to be with a particular group from Drimna or a particular group from Crumlin or a particular, you know, category. And actually, you shouldn't need, and it happens they're all on protection, so you need to go on protection to fit into that group. We should be able to facilitate people, you know, to be together on a landing without them having to have protection. And as I say, I do think the mediation approach, I do think the restorative justice approach is a way to go forward, but it is so limiting for somebody if they spend their time on protection, because they are limiting their opportunity to use the services that are available to them to turn their lives around. So it is a particular problem for us, and it is something that we are you know, very interested in resolving. And it may be the case down the road that we just have one prison that offers protection, because if we have 5 protection prisoners, we need to close the gym for 50 prisoners to bring those 5 prisoners. Yeah, so exactly. It limits everybody's ability to access services, and regrettably services are finite. So it's certainly something that we need to look at and that we need to address. And it's a long-term goal. And again, in terms of, you know, the gangland issue, I think is a particularly difficult issue, and there are feuds and factions that for everybody's safety, we need to keep separate. But outside of that, you know, there are lots of people who self-declare to go on protection, and we really need to work with that. But also we need to work with the gangland people. And it's interesting, I had a conversation with a long-term prisoner recently who sent me a proposal in terms of developing a programme to deal with people who are engaged in criminal gangs, to allow them to see a different future and a different pathway for themselves. And that doesn't necessarily, you know, mean the continuation of the pathway that they're on. So I think we, when we're looking at, you know, services and approaches, we need to make sure everybody, you know, is within our our vision, and that we're not, you know, saying just because they happen to be in a criminal gang, well then, you know, we don't have any hope for you, yeah, or you don't have a hope of a better future. I think we need to be very careful and see that everybody has a quality of opportunity in terms of what we can offer.
Maybe the prison service has an opportunity to actually, while people are incarcerated, actually resolve feuds that could have, you know, big benefits outside as well.
And we've seen that happening in a number of our prisons, certainly within the traveller cohort, which, yeah, and I suppose that's where the traveller mediation programme started, but then more broadly, you know, within other gangs, and certainly I think there's much more potential for that.
What about women in prison? So from my experience, both personal and professional, if a man goes to prison, the girlfriend will generally come up to visit, maybe bring, she'll look after the kids, pass up money for runners and tobacco and all these things. But when a woman goes to prison, the children...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Children can end up in care. Very seldom will a partner go up and visit, or pass in money for runners and tobacco. Like, is it more complex for women? Is it harsher? Is it harder for women to do time? Is there more shame and stigma attached to it? And do you manage women and men very differently within the prison service?
Yeah, I suppose if we look at the demographics of the prisoner population, so we've just over 200 women in our custody today, and a significant number of those women, you know, wouldn't be sentenced prisoners. They would be on remand. I think it's quite a small population, and I think there's a distillation of vulnerability within that population that you might not necessarily see to the same extent within men. So in many cases, there's addiction, there's homelessness, there is domestic violence, and there, people can come with very complex problems, significant issues in relation to mental illness. So we do treat women differently because under the Bangkok rules, we're actually obliged to look at the specific needs and vulnerabilities of that group. And there's a couple of really good things happening at the moment. One, we've just built a new facility for women in Limerick Prison. And I mean, I think when you see it, you know, the design is trauma informed, and it's about a normalising an environment where people can feel safe. And if they feel safe, then that they can take, you know, the steps and the small steps potentially, you know, to deal with the issues that have led them in contact with the criminal justice system. The issue of motherhood is really interesting. Actually, I had a conference with, or I had a conference call with an academic 2 weeks ago, and she presented at a Council of Europe conference I was on just around motherhood. We're going to invite her over to do some work with our staff and do some work with women within our custody, because it's hugely traumatic for the women who end up in custody and they don't know where their children are or their children may be in care. And also we need to be really mindful of the impact that has on the children. So I think there's a lot more we need to do around motherhood. You're right to say that women are not supported potentially by their families to a greater extent. And actually recently I've made some changes just in terms of what we can offer women from a hardship perspective. So we're now, I mean, and it's really simple things. You know, a lot of women when they leave prison have no clothes, and the only outfit they have is the prison outfit, yeah, which is a tracksuit, which then identifies you when you go out.
Yeah.
as an offender. So we've brought new clothing. It's a proper set of clothing. You know, we're giving you know, more personal hygiene products free of charge through the tuck shop. We're giving enhanced hardship payments, and actually that is to recognise that the needs of women are different, but also that they don't necessarily have the same family support. And a lot of women who end up in our care have really, really complex needs, and they need a huge amount of support, and they get that support while they're in custody. So Timmy, you mentioned all of the services that are there, you know, so you have a peer group, you have acceptance, you have friends, you have stability, you have routine, you've access to healthcare, you've access to mental health, and you've access to education, you've access to psychology. But when you go back to your community, you don't have the access to those services. So really what we need to start focusing on, and I think I mentioned this earlier, it's the transition piece back to the community, and it's how our communities can support really vulnerable people with complex problems so that they don't continue, you know, just to revolve within the criminal justice system.
Do you know, the restorative justice part of it, I think that's powerful. I think it's powerful because you might have a victim sitting across the table from the person who committed the crime, and I think it's very important as well, and it's very healing as well for a victim to be able to speak to the person who committed the crime and tell them how they actually felt and how they're still feeling today. And I think that can happen only when, say, for example, not when Timmy went into prison initially. It only can happen when Timmy's after doing a bit of work on himself and he's aware and he's not using drugs and, you know, he understands now that his behaviours weren't great. They did no one justice, you know, including himself. So would it be something like that? You'd be able to work it. Do you ever see something like that ever happening with the victim? I know we've spoken about how it could work within job roles and within the prison, talking to each other, but do you ever see it happening with victims of crimes?
Absolutely. So the probation service actually are leading the way in terms of restorative practices between offenders and victims. And I think there is huge potential because I suppose, and I mentioned earlier, the best way the prison service can serve victims is to ensure that no future victims of crime are created. But while people are on that journey, while they're in our care and accessing services to learn more about themselves and why they've ended up in the criminal justice system, there is, a realisation then of the harm that has been caused to them. And then the harm that they've caused to other. And I do think it's important in terms of reparation. So we do a lot, you know, and you'll know this, that there's a lot of activities that happen in prison for charities where people want to pay back the community and make a reparation for the damage that they've caused. So I do see potential in terms of the restorative practices between offenders and their victims. But that would obviously need to be victim led, and people would need to be really comfortable, and not all victims, you know, are comfortable engaging in that process, but certainly it has potential. And I think there's a lot of potential and there's a lot of benefit, not just for the victim, but the person, for themselves, to have a realization that actually they have caused harm and to understand that the impact they've had, you know, on an individual or on their community, because I think that can be really powerful in terms of desisting, you know, and making different choices in the future that doesn't end you up in that pathway where you're causing harm to your community or to individuals within the community, and also causing harm to yourself and to your family and potentially somebody's children as well.
Yeah, it's like this. This is a division I just had in my head there. It's like, I'm sitting across the table for you. You robbed my house. Or we can switch it around, vice versa. And you're telling me how you felt, telling me how your children felt, your husband, how your grandmother's ring that you had for the last three generations is gone, you know, how that made you feel, you know. You're not really worried about the money, it was some of the prized possessions that you had. That would hit you.
Yeah.
That would hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
And whether I go back using drugs or not, and I've no drugs, the next time I feel like I need to get money for drugs and rob someone's house, it's going to bring me back to that feeling that I felt while that person was telling me exactly how they felt during the restorative justice practice meeting. I think that stuff is really, really powerful, but there is there is a lot of kind of quirky bits around the edges that need to be fixed to make sure everybody's safe and they're be minded during the whole process, not just during it, the lead up, the after. I think there's even an aftercare
kind of
section that you might need for it as well,
where
you're meeting with counsellors individually, because that's a big deal. And I think you probably even need somebody in the room mediating to make sure, because that's when you're meeting somebody that is bringing up an emotional experience from you from the past where you felt a lot of anger and hatred towards somebody, and they're sitting in front of you, it can get quite intense in there. It might even, you know.
Yeah, I think it could be very powerful. But I think there are other ways for us to help people see the harm, you know, that they have caused, in the hope that, do you know what I mean, that they can reflect on that. So there are different ways I think we can do that, in terms of people telling their personal story, you know, within a group, in terms of, you know, people who've been through that process as an offender, you know, sharing, you know, just the harm that's been created. But there's definitely, I think, a huge amount of potential. You're right, it needs to be very carefully done. But I suppose for me, what's most important is that somebody, while they're on their journey to recovery, recognises that they have caused harm to their community, to their family, and to themselves, and that they make that determined effort then, you know, to try to right that wrong, particularly with themselves. And you may not be able to right the wrong, you may not be able to, you know, change the harm that's been done, but there is a different pathway for the future. And I think what's really important is that we're focusing people on the future and giving them hope and different pathways, so that that isn't an inevitability in terms of a cycle of behaviour for somebody's life, because you might have caused harm in the past, but if you can recognise that you have caused harm and the impact of that, not just on the victim, but on the wider community and your own, you know, family and community, I think there is real potential then, in terms of people making different decisions into the future.
Some of the flack we get sometimes is about, what about the victims, you know, what about the victims, which is, listen, we have to take that on the chin. But I suppose for myself and Timmy, we can't undo the things we've done. But what we try to do with our lives today is to, I suppose, make an amends in a general way for society, and to, because this is obviously shown in prisons as well, to show people that are currently in prison that there's a different life there for you. You can rebuild your life and redefine who you are. And our goal really is to have less victims in the future, like you spoke about. And a lot of the people we have on the podcast that have the personal story, they're all victims as well.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they ended up in prison later in life, but when you hear about the abuses, the neglects, the violence, the different circumstances that they've been through in their lives way before prison became into their life, they're all victims too. And sometimes crime and prison is just a symptom of all that other kind of victim stuff as well. But I suppose myself and Timmy was able to redefine our lives really through education. And it's such a key thing for myself and Timmy, just to, I suppose, to get an awareness around why our life turned out the way it did, give us the vocabulary to, you know, express ourselves and to pass on the message. But and Timmy speaks a lot about his started out his education journey within the prison. But will you talk to us about maybe some of the educational supports that are in prison at the moment? I know there's a great initiative there through Maynooth University and a kind of collection of universities there directly targeted at people that have been in prison as well.
Yeah, I suppose the first thing I'll say is it's the most shocking statistic I ever can share in relation to people who are in our care today, and that's the average school leaving age of everybody in custody today is 14.
Mm-hmm. And that's, if not you, even the junior sort, like,
if you disengage with mainstream education at 14, you're more likely to hang around the streets. You're more likely, you know, to be used by gangs, to be influenced negatively. You're more likely to get into trouble, and you're more likely then, or more unlikely to be able to find employment, or further education opportunities. So, I mean, for me, that's an incredibly stark statistic. So what we do in our schools is quite incredible, because it's not, I mean, it's adult education, but it's not a second chance. For many people, it's a first chance. And I suppose from listening to different people's stories within the education centres, what's really clear is that there is a huge amount of undiagnosed learning disabilities, you know, within the prisoner population. And I suppose that's part of the reason why the person might have disengaged with mainstream education, that they have an educational disability. They're masking that disability or the learning disability by, you know, assuming a persona that leads them to get into trouble in school, that leads them to be excluded and then takes them down a particular pathway. So, I mean, education is really, really important. We have incredible education units, so I'm so proud, and spend a lot of time in our schools. So we've got 220 whole-time equivalent teachers directly funded by the Department of Education to run adult learning centres in all of our institutions. And I think what stands out for me every time I visit a school is that they're such vibrant centres of learning. There's such a positive attitude amongst everybody. There's no judgment. You know, there's no judgment in any way in terms of your offence, in terms of your level of ability, in terms of the studies that you want to pursue, and really is an environment where you're trying to grow and nurture and develop, you know, people's innate skills and abilities. And for me, when we look at some of the incredible work that's done within our schools, I find it really sad that somebody, you know, comes to custody to find that they have an incredible talent in relation to art, an incredible talent in relation to music, creative writing, incredible talent in relation to woodwork. And it's the first time that those talents have been identified. And it's in an environment, a prison environment, where those talents have been nurtured. So I think education has a huge role to play, as I said earlier, in terms of breaking that pipeline between school and imprisonment. But the work that's done within our education centres is incredible. Last week, I was at an Open University graduation in the Midlands prison, where somebody graduated with a degree from the Open University. And there were 17 other Open University students in the room who were investing huge time and energy in terms of using as education as a way to see a different future for themselves. So there are a huge array of subjects on offer, really tailored for the needs and I suppose the interests of people who are within our care. Our teachers are absolutely incredible. Our school officers are absolutely incredible. And then the results that are achieved are absolutely incredible. And I think it's not just, you know, the piece of paper that you get, it's a love of lifelong learning that you pass on to your children. It's the recognition that education, you know, is an equaler and can give you so many opportunities in the future in terms of further education when you leave our custody or further training. So I mentioned earlier, we've been doing quite a lot of work with Minister Simon Harris, who really gets this and understands this. And one of the things we'd like to do is to look at providing apprenticeship training within custody. So there is a huge demand for apprentices, you know, right across you know, the economy. We have huge work training and education capabilities within our institutions. And what we'd like to be doing is actually providing pre-apprenticeship training. So we do a lot in terms of work training at the moment. But it doesn't necessarily lead to something. And I suppose, you know, while people are gaining, you know, qualifications, it would be great to do the pre-apprenticeship training so that people have a really clear pathway to go out onto an apprenticeship where an employer has been found, you know, while you're in custody to take you on. And I think that's really important in terms of third level education. I mean, there are really some incredible leaders in this field. You mentioned Maynooth University. I'd also mentioned Cork University and Munster Technological University. And I visited there actually this year.
They're doing the cookery chefing course.
So it's incredible. So what we have are third level institutions who see the ability and the talent and the skill and the potential of people in custody and who are willing to give people that second chance, but not just give people a second chance, but to give people additional supports so that they can be successful and they can see third level education as an opportunity for them. So there's much more I think we can do within this space. And I certainly think a lot of our focus when we're engaging with the Department of Education and SULIS, and as I say, the Department of Higher Education and Skills, is around seeing pathways for people. So there's no, it's not just good enough to do great work within, you know, your time in prison. You need to see a pathway and a really clear pathway for you, you know, into third level education or training in the community. And as I say, for the first time ever, the new National Access Plan for Higher Education specifically mentions people in contact with the criminal justice as a vulnerable and a marginalised group. So I think we're certainly well on the way in relation to that. And I think there'll be some interesting developments over the next few years.
You mentioned something there, and I think it's very important to re-mention it. It's about the apprenticeship schemes. I think that would be absolutely amazing within the prison system, firstly, because a lot of the lads who haven't been ever educated you do need a junior cert in a lot of these areas to get a trade. Maybe in electrics and plumbing, you might need the leaving cert, the equivalent in maths and English or whatever. You know, I'm sure there's ways around that too. But I think one of the most important factors is a lot of the lads, they're practically learners. They learn visually with their hands, and they're great. A lot of, like, including myself, because I'm a carpenter by trade. Academically, it wasn't something that I enjoyed, sitting in the classroom and stuff. No, I can manage it, and I'm able for it. But back in the day, I couldn't. But I think starting up an initiative like that, where you have woodwork, maybe basic plumbing, electrics within these classrooms, masonry, plastering,
yep,
painting,
yeah,
these are things. These could be massive for even the workforce that we have at the moment, where we're so behind in construction. We're missing massive, there's massive gaps in trades at the moment, you know. So I think you could definitely onto something there if you could have further talk with the minister and stuff like that. But there is the education aspect of it as well, where you need a certain level of education to get onto it.
Yeah, and I think that might help motivate people. So if you see something really practical, so for a lot of people, doing a junior cert or a leaving cert isn't, do you know what I mean, like an end in and of itself. But if you could see that doing your junior cert slowly and incrementally with support could lead to, you know, an actual apprenticeship when you leave custody, you know, which will lead to employment, which will give you stability, which will give you, you know, housing and all of those other opportunities, I think it could be seen as a really good motivation. And certainly we're making good progress in relation to that. So we have lots of opportunities for people in custody. And I suppose for me, what we're now trying to see is how we can get people to leverage that opportunity that they've taken to bring with them into, you know, the community when they leave the walls, and go back into the community. And there's huge potential there.
There's hope.
There's hope. And there's, as hope, I say, like, our prisons are places of hope and opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, that's a big deal. Like, if you're going into prison with no job opportunities or anything like that, no skills or anything, and you're doing a 3 or 4, 5 year sentence or whatever, and you're going in there and you get a bit of an education, enough to get you a trade, and you're leaving prison with a way of financially supporting yourself and your family.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. And it doesn't even need to be a full apprenticeship. So I know we've been talking to the National Construction Skills Centre, which is based in Offaly, and they do tickets to drive machinery on a building site. But some of those ticket courses, maybe 2 or 3 days or maybe a week. Mm. And there's certainly, there's a huge willingness on their part to work with us to give opportunities for people, because we know, you know, that if you go out with a job that's been secured, there's huge potential. And I think you mentioned the Open Door Initiative in Cork Prison, Munster Technological MTU, a Munster Technological University, came in and thought a culinary skills programme, you know, within Cork Prison. We then invited restaurateurs and hotel owners from across the county in. They were served an incredible dinner. But a lot of the guys who did that course got job offers on the night and have gone, you know, out into employment. And it is a game changer. So if we can really focus our attention on building those pathways for people to go back to the community and not see our job as stopping at the gate, I think we can really help people, you know, fulfill their potential. So they're realizing their potential while they're in custody with us, but fulfilling that potential means having access to employment on release, having access and the ability and the opportunity to go on to third level education, or further adult education or training. So
yeah, you said something there as well earlier on about people that are educated, they kind of pass it on to their children. I remember when my dad was in prison, he did an Open University course in the training unit at Mountjoy. It was criminology and social policy. And when he was inside, my mum did a degree in CIT in community development. No, didn't happen for me straight away, but it wasn't by coincidence that I studied both of them at bachelor's and master's degree. So, like, giving people access to education while they're inside is not soft on crime. That's how you actually prevent future crime and break the cycle.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I say that every time I talk to our teachers, that it's not just the student in the room that you're helping.
Yeah.
Instilling that love of lifelong learning and lighting that fire, you know, and that passion. And I think you said yourself, in terms of engaging in an education, learning about yourself and why you've ended up where you are, you know, and is really powerful, actually, in terms of agency and taking control of your destiny.
Yeah.
So education has an incredible role to play.
Because then you learn, like, maybe I'm not a scumbag, maybe I'm not a junkie, maybe all this stuff contributed to my behaviour. And then when you learn that, it's like, well, maybe I can have a better life now,
exactly.
because I'm not an inherently bad human being, even exactly. though I've been taught that all my life. And, you know, you just get it more critically on your environment, you know, and start joining the dots. And I always found education to be a personal development tool as well, learning about psychology, philosophy, sociology, being able to put the dots together and kind of look at my family, my own life, my community, zoom out, look at Europe, and, you know, geopolitics. And all that contributes to life outcomes for individual people. So,
but also the piece around self-esteem and self-worth. And I think that's as valuable as the certificate that you might achieve at the end, is actually realising you have a talent and realising you have a skill and realising that you can achieve. And for many people, where they get a qualification, you know, within prison, it's the first time they've had a qualification. And I love when the families come in. So I met the family of that guy who qualified or who graduated from Open University, and how proud they were of his achievement. We had Gashka gold winners, gold medal winners there, and the dad of one of the guys there, and just so how proud of that achievement. And it's an achievement against all the odds, because I know when I was talking to the guys in the room, it would be easy to spend your time on the landing, it would be easy to, you know, watch TV and play computer games. So it takes a huge amount of personal motivation to get up every day and go to school and to stick with it, and even when things become difficult, you know, or when there are problems, is to stay with it, that level of personal motivation. And as I say, that fire then in terms of continuing your education, I think is one of the most important things we can give people while they're with us.
You mentioned there, and I just want to reiterate, it's about the teachers. The teachers within the prison are absolutely amazing. The way the level they meet you, where they meet you around your education, you know, they bring you right back and they mind you, they don't push you, they take you at your own level. And I also, I got very emotional at the Gashka Awards, because one of my teachers from the Midlands prison actually came to the event, and she's my first. I always thought of her because I kept some of the books that she gave me around vowels and stuff, reading even the alphabet, even learning all these different things, and I still have them at home. And I every time I see them books, I kind of think of her, and where she met me at the level she met me, and some all the other lads as well. Like, I was never met at that level before by anybody, and it was such a beautiful thing for me to experience. But I didn't realise it at the time, because I was going through so many different things. It wasn't until after prison I was able to look back and I said, Jesus Christ, they were amazing. The way they actually treated me. It was the first time I probably was never judged on who I was, you know, by these people. Never judged, like I'm sitting inside in prison and I wasn't even judged. They were treating me with respect. They'd bring in the odd few treats here and there, and might get a packet of biscuits or something like that, and that was even a big deal, you know, a cup of tea and a packet. It was a big deal. It showed, like, they actually give a fuck, do you know, they actually care about you. And I learned so much from the teachers, and I just felt the need to commend the teachers that are in working for the prison service, because you do a fantastic job.
They're really, really incredible, like really, really incredible. But for me, I suppose the question it prompts is, why does it take somebody coming in to contact with the criminal justice system and coming into prison to be able to engage with the education system? And what is it we need to do, you know, within our communities to support vulnerable children? And actually, after this recording, I'm meeting Senator Lynn Rowan, and we're trying to work together on a project at the moment, which is around trying to do an educational assessment of everybody coming into custody between 18 and 24, so that we have a real benchmark in terms of learning disabilities. And I suppose, again, it prompts the question, how is it you end up in custody in your 20s or your 30s with undiagnosed dyslexia or undiagnosed ADHD? And how do we work within our communities and work within our education system in our communities at primary level, and maybe before primary level, to make sure that people are given those supports and given that equality of opportunity in terms of nurturing and growing the innate talents that they have?
I think having an educational psychologist within the prisons, each prison is just as important as having a clinical psychologist in there, because what they do for the lads as well is they give the lads an understanding of why they might think in a certain way or act in a certain way. And they also, even for myself, when I got assessed at the age of 36, the belief, all my core beliefs that I was stupid and tick and no good and there was something wrong with my brain, they all kind of just fizzed away once I got that assessment done. And I know a lot of the lads inside in the prison system, inside in the prisons, have the same ideas and beliefs about themselves. And yeah, that's why a lot of them won't go to education because of that.
Yeah.
Because reading is not for me, or education is not for me. It's just not. But if these assessments are done and it's explained that, oh, you've a thing called dyscalculia, dysgraphia, you're dyslexic, or, you know, that'll help them massively to understand themselves and say, do you know what, I'm going to walk now and tell the teacher I did this, and she'll tweak the learning then around that.
Absolutely.
Learning difference,
yeah,
to be able to help me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And we spend a lot of time thinking about, so the people who go to school are the people who are on that journey, you know, and actually want to make a difference. How do we reach then the people who aren't engaging in education? And on any given day, 40% of the population are engaging in education, which I think is a very high statistic. Mm-hmm. We'd like to do more. So during COVID, we introduced the Incel TV channel. And actually that's now transitioning to a blended learning model. So the ETBs in Dublin have developed 150 courses that can be played through the Incel television channel, and there's an accompanying booklet that people can do within their cells. So I suppose it's about trying to see how do we target the people within our community, our prison community, who aren't engaging in education, because they're the people, you're right, do you know what I mean, like that, whose confidence we need to build, and who we need to help make that step to go up to the school. And again, I think that's where the peer-led approach works really, really well, and I think we'd certainly like to exploit that more. We know from the work the Red Cross do that they have a huge potential to positively influence you know, other people within the environment. We know that people who are engaging in education have a huge potential, you know, to positively motivate other people. So certainly all the time we're thinking about how do we get to the people you know, who actually aren't engaging in the school at the moment. And certainly the Incel television channel is the beginning, I think, of a modernization program around Incel learning for us, but it offers people an opportunity, you know, within their cell, you know, to maybe have a look at what's on offer and have a look and actually realise that, you know, it's not, you know, rocket science, and that actually there are things maybe that would spark their interest. And I think it's important for us to make sure then that everything we're offering is of interest to people, because there's no point in offering, you know, just the traditional Leaving Cert subjects or the Junior Cert subjects. And that's not what our schools are doing. The focus is really around QQI. It's around short, you know, programs where you can have an achievement over an 8-week period, and there's a huge amount of support that's available through our schools.
Yeah, and it's great as well with the Prison TV channel, because we were delighted to get our podcast on the Prison TV channel for the very reason we spoke about there, because there will be like 40% of people going to the school, but there'll be a lot of prisoners won't go to the school. But if they might hear me or Timmy or somebody else, they can relate with on the podcast from their cell and identify, and then think, all right, I have a lot of similarities there, and they went to school and they got on, so why can't I? You might spark something.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it might give them a little bit of courage to just put their name down for the school the next
Absolutely.
Morning, you know. So that's always the motivation for us, just put your name down for the school and see where it goes. It might go nowhere.
Yeah.
Just give yourself a little try.
Yeah, and there are lots of people who go up to the school and maybe don't take any classes, and that's okay. You know, they might just take an art class, which is okay, you know. So whatever you're interested in, you know, there is a potential, you know, support for you within the education unit in the prison. And I would certainly encourage everybody, you know, to go across that edge, you know, or to cross that line, and to have faith in yourself, because there is no doubt that everybody who's followed that pathway has found that they have incredible talents and incredible gifts that then are nurtured within that learning environment.
Yeah.
Shania,
we'll leave it there, Cam.
We didn't get past the first question.
Thanks for your time. That was absolutely
brilliant, and it's great to get the perspective of yourself and the initiatives that you have in your head, and that you're working around tables to get into the prison systems to benefit prisoners.
Yeah.
You know, which so, like, will then benefit society.
But like, we're building our, so we're working on a new strategy at the moment.
If there's,
I'm still on. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah,
no, well, I'll keep you here all day now.
Yeah,
but
well,
we are working on our new strategy at the moment. But what we're trying to do is to put the service user at the centre. So for too long within our, you know, prison system, you know, we haven't. And if we were a healthcare system, we'd have the patient at the centre.
Yeah.
If we were an education establishment, we'd have the student at the centre. But we haven't always had the people in our care at the centre. of everything we do. So for our new strategy, it's very much built around our service users, and effectively everything that we do as an organisation, we should be able to relate back to delivering better outcomes for people in our care. So I think that is quite a shift. And I think that's quite a powerful shift, and it's building on what we learned during COVID, I think, which is that we can set our mind to do anything. Or sorry, we can do anything if we set our mind to it. And like at the beginning of COVID, I set my mind to keeping COVID out of our prisons, and people laughed at me. But actually between March and October, we didn't have a single case within our prison system because it was down to the determination of the people living and working in the prisons that they would all work together with a singular aim of keeping COVID out. So I think we've demonstrated that we can rally the whole organisation around delivering something really, really significant.
Actually, somebody said to me that before, like, we got COVID here around March, but somebody said to me that the prison service were actually preparing for COVID even Christmas beforehand because they see what was coming down the path.
Absolutely. So we do, and I suppose we're a learning organisation, and things go wrong in prisons, and inevitably things go wrong. But I think what's really important for us is we learn from what went wrong and we do better in the future. So we had a number of TB outbreaks in our prisons down through the years. And unfortunately, you know, both staff and people in our care were exposed to TB, which is obviously what we don't want to happen. And because of that, we built a whole infection control system within our prisons. We were ironically training our staff and donning and doffing of PPE. We had really good infection control training that was being given to all staff. We had a national infection control manager. We had the Red Cross doing things like hand washing, you know, within the environment. So while we were a really vulnerable congregated setting, and where you would have expected to have seen, you know, huge outbreaks in relation to COVID, because we were taking seriously the lessons we've learned in relation to previous infectious diseases, we were well on the way. And at one stage, we were giving PPE to hospitals because we actually started buying PPE. I got a call from my infection control manager, I think on New Year's Eve, to say, I'm looking at what's happening in China and I'm not happy with it. And can I go ahead and start doing refresher training in terms of donning and doffing a PPE? And can we start building our supplies? So it just shows you that if you're a learning organisation, and if you reflect on what's gone wrong, and if you learn the lessons, and if you implement those lessons, then you know, you're in such a stronger position for whatever might come in the future. So we've learned the lessons of COVID. And I think the other thing to say is that, like, we did a remarkable job in relation to COVID, but that's not to say there wasn't a huge impact on everybody. And I really am cognizant of that. So we got the Red Cross to do a piece of research with people in the progression unit to understand the impact of particularly the restrictions around isolation and quarantine. And I brought my full senior management team, who were the decision makers during COVID, to get the feedback into the progression unit from those Red Cross volunteers. And it was such a sobering moment because we were really clear. We made the right decisions at the right time and we had the right effect, but we didn't think enough about the impact on the individual who has been subjected to those, you know, restrictions. I think that was the case, though, right across society. But what we're now doing, actually, is we're reflecting on what we did. And we had very much an infection control led model of pandemic management. And now we've decided, actually, we need to have a mental health model for infection control into the future. So working with our psychology and our infection control team, we're reviewing all of the policies and procedures that we implemented to make sure that the next pandemic we don't, you know, do what we did the last time, but we get the same success, but while having a real focus on how we keep services open as opposed to what restrictions we implement to keep people safe. So I think that's really, really important. I think it's also important to recognize, you know, the huge impact it did have on people, the impact it had in relation to family relationships in particular. But there's some really positive things that have come out of COVID, in my view. And I suppose the realization, when somebody is behind the door, how do you get them to make a phone call? So at one stage, I'd be visiting prisons and the landings would just have wires crisscrossed because we were running wires to run, put under doors, to give phones in so people could have contact with their family. So what we've decided now is to put a phone in everybody's cell. And we've about 2,000 phones installed now so that people can make calls from their cells. But it's more than that. So my ambition is really clear that families can phone in. So it's no good if you have a 6-minute phone call a day or two 6-minute phone calls that you ring your children and they're at sports or they're at an activity or they're asleep or they're doing the homework or they're playing with their friends, or that your partner, do you know what I mean, like, might be busy, might be cooking the dinner, you know, might be working, might be shopping. So like the ambition is that families can ring in. So families can ring in directly into a cell. We're hoping 3 times a day, 3 10-minute calls. And again, that's just about normalising contact with families, because we know if you don't maintain your contact with your family, and if you don't I mean, if you can't actively parent your children, well, then when you go back out to that family, there's going to be very significant issues and challenges for you in terms of fitting in. So we learn the lessons and then we try to put our mistakes right by doing better in the future.
I know the Dillon's Cross Project here on the north side as well. They do great work with families as
well.
Incredible
work. I visited them.
Yeah, and it's very important that it's to keep that family unit together, because that is proven to reduce offending rates, you know, when people get out. But if they're disconnected from the family, they're far more likely to end up back inside for repeat offending.
Absolutely, and it certainly is part of a new strategy. Families will feature quite a lot, and we're just about to appoint a family links officer. You know, that would be taking a strategic look at how we support family relationships. And there's a lot we do, but there's a huge amount more that we can do, and we're certainly determined to do that.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of great stuff happening, and we're delighted to hear from yourself. So thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And sure, we'll probably definitely stay in contact anyway, because we've similar kind of views and ethoses and passions. So it's great. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Karen. Thanks, Timmy. Thank you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.